From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. I'm hosting the show while Julie Bierock is away. On today's edition, Christopher Conover has a conversation with Governor Janet Napolitano and discusses the possibilities of a state health care plan, as well as her experiences working alongside the new legislature. Bill Buckmaster interviews former Arizona Senator Dennis DeConcini. He has a new memoir, From the Center of the Aisle, recounting stories from his many years in politics. Could a big change in the way we pay for movie tickets be around the corner? We'll hear about the pros and cons of variable movie ticket pricing with Soo-Yun Lee. And the Catalina Chamber Orchestra will be welcoming a guest conductor from Mexico, Enrique Batiz. He'll be taking up the baton in concert January 28th, that's this Sunday, and we'll have a preview produced by Tony Paniagua. That's all next, here on Arizona Spotlight. First today, we'll hear this report from Christopher Conover. He brings us the latest installment of Conversations with the Governor.
At the beginning of the month, Governor Janet Napolitano laid out her legislative agenda for the 2007 legislative term and much of her second term in the annual State of the State address. Now she's fleshing out the details on her plans, for instance, how she plans to attract more high-tech business to Arizona.
You have a tax structure that's favorable to them, and perhaps equally or more important is you have the kind of workforce where you have people all the way through the education system where you've not just learned formulas and equations, you've learned applications and creativity, and you've also been exposed to ways experientially to be one step ahead and always be thinking about a new technology, a new medicine, or a new application of an existing technology.
Education is the key to advancing technology, according to the governor, so she's proposing a number of changes to the school system. And what much of that boils down to, according to the governor, is excitement in the classroom.
It involves, from the earliest days, increasing the expectations on our young people and increasing the excitement of learning, the relevance of what they're learning. I think some of what we teach perhaps today is not perceived by them to be particularly relevant. Right now you can drop out at 16, kids can check out at 14. You always have that argument. But at a certain point you have to say, look, how long does it take to really be 21st century ready, either to go on to more technical education, community college, or university? And the plain fact of the matter is that we simply aren't requiring enough.
To keep those students excited, the governor is looking for well-paid teachers. She wants a base pay of $33,000 a year. That compares to her request a year ago to raise the base pay to $30,000.
We add money on top of that for more experienced teachers so that you don't have a third-year teacher making less than a first-year teacher, that we provide additional incentives for teachers, particularly in math and science, that we set up a statewide continuing education system for teachers, and establish a statewide performance pay for teachers. Really, we want to appreciate teaching as a profession and provide appropriate compensation for teachers.
When it comes to children, the governor is also proposing that the state cover children living at 300% of the federal poverty level with health insurance until they're 19 years old. Her proposal comes at the same time that California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is proposing covering all California residents with health insurance. She says her plan is not necessarily a prelude to that or a similar proposal in Massachusetts.
What they're both doing is a variation on a theme, and the theme is requiring employers to pay for insurance or to pay into a pool, and also requiring healthcare providers to pay some of the money they get as reimbursement back to pay for health insurance. My jury is out on whether that's really the best way to go, but certainly it seems to me that in Arizona, we at least ought to be covering children up to the age of 19.
Many of the governor's proposals cost money and require the approval of the legislature. And during last year's legislative session, bickering between the governor and legislature continued into the summer. The governor says this year should be different.
The legislature and I will be able to work our way through all the myriad issues involved in the budget and come out with a good plan in the end. I think the plan I gave them is a very good plan. It's balanced. It allows us to invest in education. It provides a lot of new money, particularly at the university level, which is very good for Tucson. It invests in an innovation science foundation in Arizona, more money for recruiting businesses into Arizona, and then, of course, it has the capital financing I talked about.
Despite that optimism, the governor and state lawmakers already have a disagreement over the budget. The governor wants to leave the rainy day fund alone, and a Senate committee has already tried to tap the financial reserve for road building.
I think that's very unwise. The rainy day fund was empty when I became governor, and quite frankly, we need that as protection for our ongoing expenses should there be an economic downturn of significant proportions. And having come in with no rainy day fund behind me in an economic downturn and having had to work our way out of that deep hole, it was hard, and it's something I would not like to repeat. So I think we don't touch the rainy day fund first thing out of the box. We hold it as a last resort.
Only time will tell how the two branches will work their differences out. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
You're listening to Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. For almost 20 years, native Tucsonan Dennis DeConcini represented our state in the U.S. Senate. He left office in 1995. He's just released a new memoir of his life in politics, and Bill Buckmaster has the interview.
Starting his public career as the Pima County Attorney, Dennis DeConcini orchestrated an unprecedented rise to a seat in the U.S. Senate, which he held for 18 years. Along the way, he made a career out of moderation and compromise. Now the centrist Democrat, who has been out of Congress for 11 years, has finally written his memoirs, co-authored by historian Dr. Jack August, Jr. The book is titled Senator Dennis DeConcini from the Center of the Aisle and is published by the University of Arizona Press. Senator DeConcini is a founding partner of the law firm that bears his name. He's also a current member of the Arizona Board of Regents, which happens to hold the license for this television station. Senator DeConcini, good to see you. It's been a long time.
Bill, has been a long time. It's always a great pleasure to be with you. You've done so much for this university and this station and for Arizona, so it's nice to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Appreciate the kind words. Why so long to write this memoir?
It's a good question. When I left the Senate on my own accord, instead of having the voters trump me out, I started to write it. And I wrote four chapters of it, dictated it, and read it and started editing myself. And I found it was a bit bitter. And I don't know if it was the Keating hangover or that I was just burned out with Washington, because it does happen to a lot of people. So I put it aside, and then 3 years ago, I was introduced to Jack August by former staff, Virginia Turner, who worked for me for a long time, was a friend of his. And we got talking, and I thought, you know, he wanted to be involved in it. I'm very, very grateful to him. So he started editing the chapters that I had done, and I wrote some more, and then he did a lot of research and interviews, and it just kind of fell together. But it took us almost 3 years to get it all.
Wow.
As good or bad as it is.
Was there one incident that triggered your desire to get into politics, or could it go all the way back to you volunteering for the, I believe it was 1952, the losing incumbent Senator Ernest McFarland?
Yeah, it goes back to my father and mother. They were always talking politics in our family. My dad had, you know, been a Superior Court judge, Attorney General, Supreme Court judge, and then state chairman of the Democratic Party when McFarland was the majority leader and was beat by Barry Goldwater. So we were raised that way, not that you should run for office, but you should participate in the community. And when my father did community things, he would drag along my little brother and myself, my older brother and myself, and it became something of a mentoring process. So it was a natural for me. I always wanted to do it, and I had great parents that encouraged that.
Let's take a look at the political landscape since you have been in politics. Arizona, a progressive state to a very conservative state, to what is now perhaps a more moderate place. Do you like the political landscape of Arizona?
Well, I'm very encouraged and by the change, and not just because there were some Democrats elected, because actually Jim Coby was a moderate Republican that served this district and this state extremely well. We have members of the delegation who feel very, very strong about their conservative beliefs and have a feeling that government shouldn't interfere, period. And I just happened to disagree with that, so I was pleased to see Harry Mitchell succeed. I think this state misses a lot by not having more active members in the House and Senate, particularly. We had Jim Coby, which was terrific, and we have Ed Pastor, who serves on the appropriation and brings more, whatever you want to call it, special interest, but things that Arizona needs that they can't afford and the federal government should be providing, whether it's health care for veterans, it's not in the veterans bill, he puts the money in there. And that's what I did, and I think that's the job. Now, it so happens that I'm becoming the minority because there's so much waste and unauthorized but unacceptable expenditures like that. The quote, Bridge to Nowhere by Senator Stevens of Alaska, you can't explain that. What's something, and I'm glad to have an opportunity to just talk about it a minute, what people don't understand is those earmarks don't add to the deficit. What they do is they take the money away from the bureaucrats who might spend it on something very good, but it might be spent someplace else. Because the budget is passed in May, and then there's a limit set. You can't exceed that without 3/4 votes. So when you take and add some money for Davis-Monthan Air Base, housing for the troops out there, or you do the Rito River embankment that I had an earmark for, that's all taken away from the Corps of Engineers money and put there instead of going to Missouri or West Virginia or someplace else. And that to me was something that I was always proud of, but it certainly is not what is popular today because I think of the abuses of members of Congress. And Arizona should get active. We have some powerful people in the Republican Party, primarily there, and of course Ed Pastor and Grijalva in the Democratic Party, but we have some powerful people that could deliver a lot more, even going through the processes and not earmarking, and I urge them to do that, always have.
You'll probably best be remembered for sponsoring that critical amendment to the Panama Canal Treaty of 1977 that returned control of the canal to Panama by the year 2000. In hindsight, was it a good idea?
Yes, it was a good idea. It was probably the most political risky thing I ever did because the Arizona voters were against it. I had said I was against it and I campaigned against it. And when I got there, I found a different situation. And I explained it in my book, but it turned out to be that I didn't have all the information I had. And in fact, the Carter administration at the time, in my judgment, was making some misrepresentations to the public and to the Congress as to what the rights of the United States were. So my price was, you let us have the right to unilaterally intervene militarily, and I'll go along. First, I thought they weren't going to do it, and I was relieved. Fine, it's not my problem. They didn't have the votes, and so with my amendment, it brought at least 3 and maybe 5 votes. So it turned out to be the best thing. There's no question in my mind.
Probably the low point was the so-called Keating 5. That was a very difficult point for you in your career. In fact, you write that it took a great deal out of you personally and professionally.
Indeed it did, Bill. I was raised to be ethical, and I made full disclosure of my income tax and my financial statements yearly, even when my father said, don't do it if you don't have to, and there was no rules that made you do it, but I felt that it was part of public obligation. So being accused of ethical wrongdoing and then what I feel that the prosecutor in the case was totally biased against me and Don Riegel and Alan Cranston, 2-3 fine senators, and even to some extent John Glenn, I was very upset about it, and I even passed my mind to resign. I said, I don't need this. I'm glad I didn't do that. Fortunately, the Ethics Committee found that we broke no laws and no rules, although they criticized 4 of us for being over-aggressive and conducting ourselves in a way that might be interpreted as not proper. But they just said we broke no rules or laws. We had, you know, in hindsight is wonderful, Alan Greenspan then, before he was Federal Reserve Chairman, had given us an 80-page justification, which I relied on and I'm sure others did. Turned out to be a mistake, and Mr. Keating cut corners and broke the law.
Senator DeConcini, a pleasure.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you very
nice
much.
Nice to be with you.
With
Thank
tonight.
You once again.
Senator DeConcini will be discussing and signing copies of his new book, published by the University of Arizona Press, on Friday, February the 2nd, from noon to 2 p.m. at the University of Arizona Bookstore at the Student Union Memorial Center. Everyone is invited to come out and say hello to the senator.
After the break, do some movies deserve to have more expensive tickets while others are discounted? And would this be decided before or after the reviews come in? Also, a legend in classical and Mexican music comes to Tucson to perform. Next, here on Arizona Spotlight. Just this week, Hollywood announced the Oscar nominations, which starts the anticipation for the Academy Awards ceremony, which will be held at the end of February. Now, we've all seen movies that definitely deserved awards, and we've seen movies that we should probably have gotten paid to sit through. One University of Arizona professor says that with all the competition out there, now would be a good time for the film industry to re-examine what they charge us to view their product. Soo Yun Lee reports.
Thank you very much.
Have you ever wondered why we pay the same price for a hit movie as we do for one that's a flop? Or have you wondered why we pay the same for a movie on Friday night as we do for a movie on Monday night?
This is actually a question which is around for many years. It's a kind of a coffee table conversation for economists.
Movie enthusiast and law professor Barak Gorbach tried to find some answers why through his research.
One of the first things I did was to talk with exhibitors. And actually, one of the first answers I received was from someone who told me, I'm in the business for 40 years. My dad was in the industry for all his life. We've always had this with this type of uniform pricing, and we'll always do. I started looking about the past, and I quickly found out that this wasn't the case in the past.
Orbach teaches law and economics at the University of Arizona. He recently published an article entitled Uniform Prices for Differentiated Goods, which explains how movie theaters could increase their profits by exercising variable pricing.
It's one thing that the paper does is to present the question why it is unusual to have one price for different products, and especially in the context of movies, how you could do it in a different ways. My co-author and I do in this paper is basically we would present the demand for movies, and we show that movie going on weekends is very much different than movie going during the week, during weekdays. And also we show that the demand for certain movies is very different than the demand for other movies. So this is one thing that we show that it's possible. Another thing that we do is that we try to understand why the industry doesn't change its practices and doesn't transform to variable pricing. And the reasons there are very complex, but essentially they converge to some major things. One thing is that exhibitors are afraid that moviegoers would be unhappy and would perceive it as unfair. Another thing is that they confuse the uncertainty around the demand for movies with other things. And the last thing is that the studios are not always happy about the ideas of different prices for different movies. So these are the major reasons.
So here's what could happen with variable pricing. You might have to pay more for a Friday night movie, but you might pay 50% less for a weeknight movie.
This is generally a better way to conduct business. This is why airlines have different pricing. And this is why other industries, you know, hotels and stuff like that. But in the case of movies, what we are going to see is that some people really don't have flexibility when they watch movies. Some consumer will benefit, some consumers probably will not benefit. What would be the total effect? We don't know.
The major exception to uniform pricing is matinee rates. However, discounts for seniors, students, and children do not represent price differentiation because they uniformly apply to all movies and all showtimes.
The reality is that it is quite difficult to be an exhibitor today, and many exhibitors go out of business. Sure, some people will make more money, but the question is what we are going to get in return. And I think that what we are going to get in return are two things. One thing is that supply will follow the demand in a better way, which means that people who would like to watch movies, which are now sold out, they would be and are willing to pay more, they'll be able to see the movies. Other people who don't care much about Friday nights, they will go to see the movie on other days and pay less. It will be a better allocation of movie going thing. Another thing, which is marginal but still exists, that there will be some more money because there will be some more movie going and there will be a little bit more profit. And perhaps at the margin, it will allow some exhibitors to survive or perhaps to make the movie going experience a little bit better.
Orbach dismisses the popular argument that variable pricing would be too costly to administrate and too confusing for moviegoers. He says in the past, moviegoers were sophisticated enough to handle variable pricing, and there's no reason to believe that today's moviegoers are any less sophisticated. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Suyan Lee.
This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. Our metropolitan area is fortunate to have three chamber orchestras, and one of them is preparing for a special performance this weekend. The founder and conductor of the State of Mexico Symphony Orchestra is visiting Tucson for the first time. As guest conductor, he's leading the Catalina Chamber Orchestra in a concert of Mexican and classical favorites this Sunday at the Berger Center. Maestro Enrique Batiz spoke about his life and work during a rehearsal with the Catalina Chamber Orchestra for this Sunday's concert.
Well, my grandmother was a piano teacher, and so she had a kindergarten, and I lived with her since the age of 4 until I was 10. So at the same time that I went to school, I learned the lessons that she taught in the piano to the other grown-up people. I started playing the piano when I was 4, and then I finished my schools in Mexico, came to the United States for 7 years, then left to Europe for another 4, and finally, I convinced myself that I should be living in my own country. This orchestra, the Mexico State Orchestra of the State of Mexico, and it's funded by the state, paid everything. But the good thing about this symphony is that there's freedom for sponsorships and as well as artistic freedom.
Andantes in 4. Enter in the right beat. Start andante.
What is your message as you travel around the world into places like Tucson when it comes to music and Mexico?
Well, I think music is universal and therefore it's for the ears of people. And classical music is not to be alien as opposed to the popular music songs or to opposed to the popularity of folk singers or rock and roll. I enjoy classical music more than everything. I mean to say more than anything, because it gives me the joy in my spirit. I am rewarded when I do it, even in rehearsal or in concerts, thinking that nothing is more important than what we are listening at this point. Time stops.
Not like that. It's just enough that should be heard. But I think the minimum, we have six, so four of you should play the minimum.
And what do you want to tell the people here in Tucson and Southern Arizona?
Well, we tell anybody who is living in the United States, including Tucson, that you have a lot of friends in Mexico, and that we admire very much many things in the American style, in the American life, and we consider all of you friends.
I'm Enrique Lazansky, the music director of the Catalina Chamber Orchestra. One of the musical agencies, Price and Rubin, came and heard a concert of the Catalina Orchestra about 3 years ago, and they approached me with the possibility of doing an exchange with another orchestra and conductor. And one day they called, they said, well, would you like to go direct this orchestra, and we'll have Mr. Batis come here and direct your orchestra? And I said, well, that sounds great. So I did that. I conducted that orchestra in April. We did two concerts, one in Toluca and one in Mexico City. And now it's his turn to come here and work with my orchestra. And I'm very excited because he's a very experienced conductor. He's conducted with many of the world's greatest orchestras, London Philharmonic, Royal Philharmonic. Has made many recordings. And it's just very exciting, as the founder of this orchestra, to have this very accomplished conductor come and conduct this group. So yeah, we're very excited about it.
Of course, they can expect quality playing and quality listening. Since they can come, they can be assured that this will be a very highly performed concert of music.
Enrique Batis conducts the Catalina Chamber Orchestra this Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Berger Performing Arts Center on West Speedway. For more information, the number is 401-4369. And that is Arizona Spotlight for this week. As always, thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of Arizona Spotlight are available online at kuaz.org. Podcasts are also available. I'm Mark McLemore.